creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, another car bomb explodes, this one at the police headquarters in Baghdad. Where are Iraq's leaders?
And who's behind the bombings? We speak to a reporter in Baghdad who says the guerrilla war is largely homegrown.
Also, he has eyes but cannot see. One man's journey back to sight after 40 years of blindness.
It would be very obvious to people if a child was brought up without language that they would be able to hear, but they wouldn't be able to understand language. And I think you can see the world without being able to understand the language of the visual world.
Plus, the dubious distinction of most persistently dangerous school.
And favorite unsung film actors.
These stories coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. Massachusetts Senator John Kerry officially launched his campaign for the presidency today at an aircraft carrier in a Charleston, South Carolina harbor. The Democrat used the opportunity to blast the president's policies on Iraq, saying George Bush's vision does not live up to the America he defended.
Being flown to an aircraft carrier and saying mission accomplished doesn't end a war. And the swagger of a president saying, bring 'em on, will never bring peace or safety to our troops.
Kerry stood alongside several crew members of the gunboat he commanded in the Vietnam War. Hundreds of thousands in the Iraqi holy city of Najaf listened today as the brother of the Shiite Muslim cleric slain at a mosque last week criticized the Americans for occupying his country and demanded they get out. The funeral was symbolic as the body of Ayatollah Mohammed Bakir al-Hakim was never recovered from the wreckage of last week's car bombing. As the funeral was about to get underway, another car bomb exploded near the main police compound in Baghdad, killing an Iraqi policeman. The newly appointed police chief was not in the building at the time, but as NPR's Ivan Watson reports from Baghdad, he apparently was the target of the attack.
The organizers of these bombings are not giving the U.S. and its Iraqi allies any time to even bury their dead. This explosion comes on the day of a massive funeral service in the holy city of Najaf. And Iraqi police say the target of this attack was the chief of police. The U.S. has had an instrumental role in arming, in paying, in uniforming these police, saying that they are the key to bringing stability back to this country.
NPR's Ivan Watson in Baghdad. In Indonesia, a Muslim cleric has been sentenced to 4 years in prison for his role in a plot to overthrow the government. From Jakarta, the BBC's Rachel Harvey reports.
After 8 hours of deliberation, the panel of five judges delivered their verdict to a packed courtroom. The prosecution, they said, had failed to prove that Abu Bakr Bashir was the head of the militant Islamic organization Jama'a Islamiyah, and therefore the elderly cleric could not be found guilty of leading a treasonous plot. But the judges said Abu Bakr Bashir was guilty of conspiring to overthrow the secular government of Indonesia in order to replace it with a strict Islamic state. The presiding judge said the relatively light sentence of 4 years in prison took into account Abu Bakr Bashir's advanced years and his polite conduct in court. In response, the radical cleric described the verdict as evil and said he would appeal.
The BBC's Rachel Harvey reporting from Jakarta. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Industrials are up 8 points to 94.24 in moderate trade. The Nasdaq is up 5 points to 18.15. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the nation's manufacturing sector showed signs of growth for a second straight month, though the industry continued to shed jobs. That's according to a survey of purchasing managers. We get more from NPR's Jack Spear.
The report from the Institute for Supply Management showed overall manufacturing grew last month. The group's purchasing managers index was at 54.7, an increase of nearly 3% from July. A reading over 50 generally denotes expansion, while the reading below that means contraction in manufacturing. The survey also showed a strong increase in manufacturing production. However, on the employment side, the news was less upbeat. The group's employment index fell again in August. It has remained below the break-even point for 35 consecutive months. Speaking over the weekend to a group of laborers in Ohio, President Bush made note of the continued loss of U.S. manufacturing jobs. He also announced creation of a new high-level position within the Commerce Department to address the needs of hard-hit manufacturers. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan is lunching with President Bush today. The meeting comes a day after the president conceded that Americans are still having a tough time finding jobs. White House spokesman Scott McClellan says today's meeting is the latest in a series of talks Greenspan and the president have been holding on the economy. McDonald's is coming out with a new slogan today in the hopes that it will revive the fast food business. The catchphrase in the new ad campaign is, "I'm loving it." McDonald's hopes the ads will make a connection with young adults, soccer moms, and kids. McDonald's recently bought into a new chief executive and has shut down hundreds of restaurants. Germany was selected as a launch venue since the slogan was created by a German ad agency. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces All Songs Considered 3, the newest compilation of music heard on All Things Considered at npr.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Today, a car bombing outside Iraqi police headquarters in Baghdad killed one police officer and wounded some 13 people. Meanwhile, two cars packed with explosives were discovered before they could detonate in the holy city of Najaf, all against the backdrop of turbulent outpourings of grief for assassinated Ayatollah Mohammed Bakir al-Hakim. At the Ayatollah's funeral before his burial in Najaf, his brother spoke, angrily demanding the U.S. do more to control violence, reflecting a deepening sense in Iraq that someone needs to take charge. We're joined now by Hassan Fatah from Baghdad, who is the editor of Iraq Today. Welcome, Mr. Fatah.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for joining us. Hassan, how has the assassination of Ayatollah Mohammed Bakir al-Hakim affected Iraqi's sense that no one's in control?
I think it was a very defining moment in the history of this occupation, if not in the history of this country. Hakim was had a huge standing in the community, to the point that you actually have had mourning sessions or grieving throughout the country, ranging all the way from Mosul all the way down south to Basra.
So it's not just Shia Muslims who are mourning him.
No, no. In fact, that's what's so profound about this experience, in fact, is that the entire country has been in a state of shock and, to some, in such a large extent, mourning. Throughout Baghdad, in neighborhoods that are Christian, neighborhoods that are Sunni, Shia, you see the tapestries that are put up to announce the death and grieve the death of Hakim. It's a very, very profound event that has happened in this country.
The death of the Ayatollah highlights for Iraqis that there is no one on the landscape who can emerge in a time of crisis and go on television or go around the country and present a sense of leadership and direction.
To some extent, yes, but in fact, also to some extent, no. The fact that there hasn't been all-out fighting in the middle of the streets speaks to a certain leadership that is happening in communities. It speaks to the fact that there have been some wise leaders among communities in the neighborhoods and in various areas that have realized that what is happening here, what this explosion was all about, was an attempt to bring out a civil war. And that hasn't happened in 3-4 days now. In a way, that's a very positive sign. It speaks to the fact that there is some form of leadership, and yet we need to find out who that leadership is.
And that form of leadership, though, Hassan, is not the Iraqi Governing Council, right, which has been virtually invisible since the Ayatollah was assassinated. You're seeming to suggest that it's coming, what leadership there is, much more from the grassroots.
Absolutely. I think that there's been some really wise people on the grassroots who've managed to keep tempers down.
Yeah. Very much a galvanizing event, this assassination.
to say the least. This is very much a galvanizing event, and I think that people realize how much of a definitive moment this is. And I think that's why, in essence, good things as well as bad things have come out of this. The question is, what happens in the next week or two? Does this bring everybody together, or does it tear everyone apart?
Hassan Fattah, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Hassan Fattah spoke to us from Baghdad. He's editor of Iraq Today.
The violence in Iraq also raises questions about who exactly is the enemy. Today, U.S. Civilian Administrator Paul Bremer said an influx of foreign fighters from around the region demonstrates that Iraq is one of the battlefields against worldwide terrorism. But at least one observer says the resistance in Iraq is largely homegrown. Tracy Wilkinson is a correspondent with the Los Angeles Times. She's on the line from Baghdad, where she heard today's car bombing reverberate. Tracy, who do you think is planting these bombs?
Well, you know, there are two aspects of this guerrilla war. There are the bombings. I think this is the fourth now in 27 days, I was trying to count up, which is one level of terrorism. I mean, many of the targets and victims are civilians here. And then there are the other attacks on the American troops, daily, about a dozen a day attacks. The bombings represent not necessarily a high-level sophistication, but certainly a lot more organization and coordination. The ambushes of American troops tend to be more the work of localized cells that don't need a lot of sophistication, coordination, or even very, very much weaponry. These tend to be, from what I can tell, mostly Iraqis. Many are former members of the regime, that sort of thing, but augmented by a growing number of Iraqis who are fed up, disgusted, and very hateful of what they see as a repressive occupation.
And also augmented, as you write, by people who are crossing borders. As you write, the two first arrests in the mosque bombing were Saudis. Is this, as you say, a temporary marriage of convenience?
Well, clearly there are many foreign fighters crossing into Iraq. The number is not clear. The American military will not reveal the full number. Some speak of a couple of hundred. There have been reports of larger numbers. The extent to which, though, they are hooking up with the more homegrown Iraqi cells is unclear. I think there may be beginnings of some coordination and linking. Now, whether actual al-Qaeda people have come in, again, the Bush administration claims that some have, but that is still very much in its early stage, and it's hard to say to what extent they are hooking up with these cells that are pretty well established all over, or certainly central Iraq.
Tracy, we've heard about the bombings and these horrendous landmines that have continued to kill U.S. soldiers, but you also write about attacks that have been off our radar, the kidnappings in Baghdad to raise money for attacks against U.S. forces, hired mercenaries, dead dogs being used as carriers of bombs and left on the sides of the road. What is the feeling in Baghdad right now? Pretty jittery?
Yes, very jittery. There are many kidnappings. There are many murders, many carjackings. There's a sense of insecurity, and no one is safe.
Tracy, thank you.
Thank you.
Tracy Wilkinson of the Los Angeles Times speaking to us from Baghdad.
Well, U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge said recently the nation still has a long, long way to go to improve homeland security. Today, some specifics. Ridge is proposing that customs and immigration agents be cross-trained so they can also be used as armed marshals on airplanes. And Secretary Ridge also wants to establish secure phone and video conferencing lines with states to share information about terrorist threats. On the line to discuss the state of homeland security is Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. He's the Republican lead governor on homeland security issues for the National Governors Association. The governor joins us from the Massachusetts State House, and welcome, Governor Romney.
Thank you, Bill. Good to be with you.
Governor Romney, let's start in your own front yard, downtown Boston. How satisfied are you that first responders, police and fire departments and hospitals and so on, are sufficiently prepared for another, God forbid, 9/11?
Well, I don't think it's ever possible to be entirely prepared for the kind of terror which can be visited upon a community. I do think there's been an enormous advance to assure that in the instances of relatively limited type of terrorist attacks, that people can get adequate hospitalization and that there can be good response. But the area of my greatest concern is less with our response to an act of terror and our ability to treat and care for people, and more our ability to prevent an attack in the first place. First prevention needs to receive at least as much attention as first response.
What about intelligence? Are you getting all the information you feel you need and direction to particularly protect particularly vulnerable parts of a state, chemical plants, power plants, bridges?
Well, I believe that we're getting excellent information from Washington, D.C. and from our own sources here that we're able to act upon when there's a great deal of specifics which accompany that information. Unfortunately, a lot of the intelligence which comes from Washington is based on their sources, which are sometimes not very credible. Sometimes they don't give the kind of specifics you'd like to have. Of course, we'd like to have a better intelligence capability. And in fact, an area that I think we can make a major stride in is to coordinate our intelligence gathering efforts at the local level with those at the state level and further with the federal level. The federal government's giving us pretty good information. I'm just not so sure whether we're processing and providing to them all the information we could.
Huh. How can that be changed?
Well, I believe that we need to really sit down, much the way that we did actually when I had the opportunity to run the Olympics out in Salt Lake City, where we created in that case, an Olympic Public Safety Command, where federal, state, and local officials worked together and actually were housed in the same building. We have a interagency, interlevel task force on terrorism. But I'd like to make sure that our state police and their terrorist intelligence efforts, as well as those of Boston and other cities and the federal government, are more highly coordinated. And I think you're going to see progress there.
There's a lot of uneasiness out there, though, Governor, as you know. Two private studies released last week concluded police, firefighters, and other emergency workers, those first responders we talked about at the beginning of our conversation, still feel unprepared for another 9/11. Isn't it time for them to feel prepared?
Progress has been made. We have more hazmat teams. We have more mobile command centers. We have much better intelligence and intelligence sharing. But the level of support for first response and first prevention will probably need to increase over the years as terrorist threats become more than just threat, but reality.
But, Governor, it must make you even personally feel very uneasy that first responders still feel like they're not being adequately supported.
I'm sure some feel that they would like more resources. I know that when I was at the Olympics, we had one locality step forward and say they wanted a helicopter. We had another said they wanted an armed personnel carrier. They wanted more equipment. They wanted more money. They wanted more employees. And when they don't get those things, they think they're not getting all that they need. Fortunately, I think the way to approach our homeland security challenges is by assuring that each state is able to develop a comprehensive homeland security plan and that resources are allocated according to that plan. You're not going to find any governor who's not going to be banging on Washington's door asking for more. But we want to make sure that the money we ask for is actually being applied to technology, to equipment, and to personnel that are performing homeland security missions under a state plan, rather than just more money from the federal government going to cities and towns, which they can use any way they want.
Just to finish then, still very much a work in progress, making sure we're as secure as we possibly could be from another 9/11.
I think our level of preparedness to respond to homeland security threats is greater than it has ever been and is actually in good shape. We're making progress, but there's a good deal of progress ahead of us.
Governor Mitt Romney of Massachusetts, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Bill.
Governor Mitt Romney is the Republican lead governor on homeland security issues for the National Governors Association.
Just ahead, a blind man regains his vision but has to learn how to see.
And later in the program, a Texas school superintendent says his school was unfairly labeled persistently dangerous.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
For most of us, it's automatic. We are born, our eyes open, and we begin learning to see. And we don't see just with our eyes, but with our brains. And while most of us never have to think about the process of learning to see, at least one man has been thinking about it a lot lately. He's Mike May, a 43-year-old California man who's been blind from early childhood. Blind, that is, until experimental stem cell surgery 3 years ago gave him back the sight in one eye. Ever since, he's been struggling to adapt to the visible world. Mike May joins us now, and welcome, Mike.
Good day.
Well, Mike, you were blinded by a chemical explosion when you were just 3 years old. Then your vision was partly restored through this experimental procedure. What was it like when the bandages came off?
It was quite a surprise to all of us because we had set the expectation pretty low. We didn't know if the operation would work, if it did, how much, and when. And certainly I wasn't thinking about it working right away and having as much visual activity as I did as soon as the bandages came off.
Was it a flood of light and form that you immediately understood or something else?
No, it was definitely a flood, and the first thing that came into view was all of the lights and the doctor and white and black instruments and so forth, and then that resolved into a much more agreeable picture of my wife sitting there near me and smiling and asking me what I could see, and really I started from that moment viewing the world one image at a time and putting objects together in terms of all these visual clues that help make up each one of the images. So my wife, for example, on that first day, I see blonde hair, blue pants, and a few clues like that, but I had to think about each one of them individually. Face, okay, that's a face. I think about that. So it takes me 5-10 seconds to figure out her general image.
Aha. Almost a kind of slow motion piecing together of blue pants and blonde hair and face equals wife.
That's right. And the difference between that moment and today is now that I've seen her plenty of times, it happens for me in a second. Not as quickly as it would for you, but still a lot quicker than that first day.
Were you afraid at all when you first were able to see?
There were certain situations that were definitely a bit intimidating. The first was getting in a vehicle as we drove home and seeing these large objects hurtling by us, appearing to almost crash into us. And my wife, Jennifer, was so nonplussed about it all. It was no big deal because, of course, it was just an everyday driving experience for her. And it was a very unique experience for me. They looked quite close.
Huh. Well, let's bring someone else into the conversation now. Ione Fine, who's a vision researcher at the University of Southern California Doheny Eye Institute. She published a paper this month in the journal Nature Neuroscience about Michael's incredible journey back to sight. And welcome, Ione.
Thank you.
Ione, were you surprised when Mike was able to see faces but not really make sense of them?
I was very surprised. One of the interesting things about site recovery is people have been fascinated by it for centuries, but there's still very little in the literature really sort of describing what the experiences are like for people who recover their sight.
Now, you've actually done some scans to try to understand how Mike's brain is working when he sees. What did you learn from that work?
What we found with the scans is that the regions of the brain that are responsible for processing motion seemed very, very normal. And that's very consistent with Mike's experiences, that when he's driving home, he's frightened, but that's actually quite a sensible response to a Californian freeway, especially for your first time seeing it. But areas that were responsible for things like objects and face processing were almost inactive. In a normal subject, when you show a face, there's a region of the brain that just lights up. And in Mike, that didn't happen.
Why?
I think it's because face processing is something that relies very heavily on visual experience, and Mike hasn't had that visual experience. We think of face processing as something that's very automatic, but in fact, faces are very, very similar. To a sheep, we all look alike. To us, sheep all look alike. A lot of being able to discriminate faces is simply our incredible experience with them.
Uh-huh. Now, Ione, what does this tell us on an almost philosophical level about the picture of the world we have in our heads?
I think the thing that has most fascinated people about this is the fact that there's this difference between seeing and perceiving. It would be very obvious to people if a child was brought up without language that they would be able to hear, but they wouldn't be able to understand language. And I think the thing that, you know, really gets people excited about this research is it sort of makes it very clear that you can see the world without being able to understand the language of the visual world, that the visual world has a set of rules, and it's very like a language. There's a structure to it that is quite a complicated structure, and we learn it in infancy, and then we take it for granted. But it's actually quite amazing that our brains have that language.
Mike, I've read something you said, that vision has not changed your life all that dramatically. What do you mean?
I think of the vision experiences I've had as being like going to a new country. I'm always fascinated. It's something that helps in other aspects of my life because I've learned a new culture, met new people. It's like that. It's enriching. But in fact, of functionally changing things, I don't have to rely on it. In fact, it's just an augmentation. It's a benefit, but it's not something I have to depend upon.
Mike May, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And Ione Fine, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ione Fine is a vision researcher at the University of Southern California Doheny Eye Institute. Michael May is a California businessman who's had his vision restored after a lifetime of blindness.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, hearings begin in Washington on the great blackout of 2003.
And the four most painful preschool words: they don't like me. How to help little kids deal with bullying and teasing in the classroom. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, a Texas superintendent wonders, will schools stop reporting incidents of violence to avoid being labeled persistently dangerous?
And no more pencils, no more books. It used to be sung at the end of the school year, not the beginning. How teachers are spending their own money to buy supplies.
Also, we sing the praises of unsung actors, such as The Godfather's John Cazale.
I can handle things. I'm smart. Not like everybody says. Like dumb, I'm smart, and I want respect.
These stories, coming up here and now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. Massachusetts Senator John Kerry made it official today. He's running for president. Ari Shapiro reports.
Senator Kerry emphasized his military experience by appearing in front of an aircraft carrier surrounded by crew members from the Navy gunboat that he commanded in Vietnam. The senator's speech targeted President Bush and less so Kerry's Democratic rivals.
George Bush's vision does not live up to the America I enlisted in the Navy to defend, the America I have fought for in the Senate, and the America that I hope to lead as president.
Kerry emphasized themes such as the environment, poverty, and unemployment. He's running second to Governor Howard Dean in polls in New Hampshire. The first presidential primary will take place there in January. This is Ari Shapiro reporting.
A car bomb struck outside a police station in central Baghdad. Several people are reported injured. The attack comes a day after a roadside bomb killed two U.S. soldiers. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of mourners have come together for the funeral of an Iraqi spiritual leader. Ayatollah Mohammed Bakr al-Hakim was killed in a car bombing of a mosque last week that claimed scores of other lives. The top U.S. administrator in Iraq, Paul Bremer, is offering his condolences.
Once again, as twice before in the past month, the terrorists have taken innocent lives. Once again, the terrorists have shown they will stop at nothing in the pursuit of their aims, but they shall be stopped. We will stop them. We shall combat them, and we shall overcome them.
Reporter Lourdes Navarro was in the holy city of Najaf for the arrival of the funeral procession.
Not exactly a service. This has been a three-day mourning ceremony. It started in Baghdad, where a symbolic coffin was taken on a flatbed truck, and it's been carried from city to city, finally ending up here in Najaf.
Later, in a eulogy, the brother of the slain cleric angrily denounced the U.S. occupation of Iraq. Former prisoner of war and national hero Jessica Lynch has agreed to a $1 million book deal with publisher Alfred Knopf. In a statement issued today by Knopf, Lynch says she feels she must tell her story, saying she owes it all to the people who have supported her. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 18 points at 94.33, and the Nasdaq is up 7 at 18.17.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
School administrators across the country are grappling this year with a new and unwanted dishonor, the title of persistently dangerous. The label is part of the federal No Child Left Behind Act, but schools earn the dubious distinction based on standards set by individual states, and those standards vary widely. And parents of students who attend the so-called persistently dangerous schools can transfer their child elsewhere. According to a Christian Science Monitor report, fewer than 100 schools nationwide have received the label, 27 of them in Philadelphia, just two in New York City, and the superintendent of at least one in Texas says his school doesn't deserve it. Dr. Sylvester Perez is superintendent in San Marcos, Texas, home of the Doris Miller Junior High School. Welcome, Dr. Perez.
Good afternoon.
And Doris Miller has received this unsafe designation. Is it a dangerous school?
Absolutely not. An interesting fact is that the school resource officer that was assigned to Doris Miller Junior High was reassigned because he did not have enough to do.
How did he get the label?
Well, what has happened here is for 3 years, we had some incorrect data that was submitted to our Texas Education Agency. And basically, we had some hitting and shoving, throwing of a pencil, those types of things that were coded, for instance, a 29 or a 30 instead of a 21.
Well, we should explain that Texas qualifies schools as dangerous if they report a minimum of 3 expellable offenses per 1,000 students for three years in a row.
Years,
right. And so those expellable offenses could be what?
An illegal knife or felonies that occur, assaults on adults, administrators, or assaults on other students, those types of things.
In fact, I hear that what actually happened in the school was that a student had a sharp object, but it was a protractor, not a knife. Somebody unplugged a freezer, somebody threw a pencil, and
right.
These events just got miscoded.
Correct.
And so they went into the formula wrong.
Right.
Do any funds then go to the school to correct the problem?
No, absolutely not. There are no resources that are provided. There's no transportation monies that are provided for parents who want their sons or daughters transferred to another, quote, school that is much safer. I think that what that has done is basically given us in the school business another unfunded mandate.
Right. And also, I'm wondering, if other schools are watching this from the sidelines now, they're thinking, I'm not going to report when a kid does something wrong.
Right. If this is the case, and if you're looking at dangerous schools, I can tell you that administrators would much rather be dealing with a low or poor academic performing school than one that's labeled, quote, dangerous.
And you look at the stats, as we said, less than 100 schools are now on this list, none in the entire state of California, which has more than 9,000 schools.
I think that right there probably validates the flaw in this system more than anything else. I mean, people are not dumb. People really understand what's politics and what's well-intended and perhaps what's flawed as a system. I think that the federal government, again, may have been well-intended, but the end result can be extremely damaging. When I'm talking about intent, I'm talking about the No Child Left Behind Act, of course, of 2001. You know, we're for stronger accountability results and options for more flexibility and some local control, and especially research-based methods in the area of reading and others. But whenever you had this one specific law that is out there that dealing with persistently dangerous schools and this label, without having the criteria in place and with having 50 different types of reporting standards by each state, there's a definite flaw in the system.
Well, what do you do now?
We have appealed, and interestingly enough, when we asked the agency what the appellate process was, the answer we received was there is not an appellate process in place. So we consulted with our attorneys, and we are writing a letter to the interim commissioner, and hopefully common sense will come into play at some point, and they'll realize that although we had clerical mistakes, this is very damaging misinformation to our community and to the public.
Can you see a case where a school might get this designation and you would think as a superintendent, yeah, that's really good, and in fact, I hope they shut that school down?
Not really. If you have this kind of a school that's that dangerous, I can tell you without identifying a school district where a student was stabbed to death a year ago, the community came to the front and comprised an ad hoc committee that was going to do nothing but address the safety issue of that particular campus. And they came up not only with a good product, but a great process. And that school is better because of it and much safer now than it was a year ago.
So the community took care of it. But I'm thinking also that according to the formula, at least in most states, someone would have to be stabbed to death and then have other incidents of that magnitude 3 years in a row.
Isn't that something?
To be designated a dangerous school.
Isn't that something? See, and that's what we're saying here in our region, how can school X not be on this list? And we have absolutely zero kids that were expelled, and they have perhaps a student that's been tried and convicted of murder.
Well, Superintendent, thank you.
Okay.
Dr. Sylvester Perez is the superintendent of the San Marcos, Texas school system, where the Doris Miller Junior High School just won the dubious distinction of persistently dangerous school. Well, a recent survey found that teachers spend an average $589 of their own money to equip their classrooms. And that number is expected to go higher as cash-strapped states cinch their belts. Joining us on the line is Jean Hayes. She's president and founder of Quality Education Data in Denver, Colorado. Hello, Jean.
Hi.
I know you helped conduct that survey that I just mentioned. What are teachers buying?
In elementary schools, posters and materials to do bulletin boards and to make the classroom a friendly environment. If you think about secondary schools, they're looking, as our elementary teachers, at classroom libraries and other kinds of things that just need to be in that place where kids come.
Are there certain groups of teachers that spend more or less than others?
Interestingly enough, the most common is a new teacher. A new teacher doesn't have any backlog of supplies, and she, usually it is a she, spends up to $700 of her own money in her first year of teaching, and even in her second. And she will be really equipping that classroom.
And then also, teachers might spend more in, it would make sense in areas that might be economically harder hit.
Right. There are two other groups where we find that teachers spend more than the average. And one is, in fact, schools that are in socioeconomic areas that are lower than average. So if you're in a poor school, a lot of teachers are part of the group that are making up the difference.
We know the economy is terrible in some ways, especially when it comes to state budgets. But what other reason might teachers be spending more?
Well, if you think about it, teachers are a special breed, and there's an increased focus to demand greater accountability and greater achievement. And I think in any way they feel they can help, they will.
Well, the federal government obviously is paying attention to this. President Bush signed into law last year a $250 million federal tax credit for teachers who spend their own money, and apparently that's going to be continued. Does that help?
Certainly it helps. It isn't equivalent to what the average teacher spends, and certainly not to those who are spending far more, but any little bit helps.
And remind us, Jean, we speak about teachers spending, you know, over $500 on average, some as much as $700, $800 a year on school supplies. What's the average teacher's salary?
The most recent study shows that the average teacher's salary is about $44,000, the lowest of any professional group with college degrees.
Mm-hmm. Jean, thank you.
Thank you.
Jean Hayes is president and founder of Quality Education Data, the education research arm of Scholastic, based in Denver, Colorado.
Still to come, we sing the praises of some of the most unsung performances on film.
You're listening to Here and Now.
An old argument, nature versus nurture. Which matters more? How you're made, your genes and all that, or where you're from, how you were brought up. Well, lower IQ scores among minorities have been used by some to support claims that minorities are genetically inferior. But a new study finds that while the link between genes and IQ may be real, differences in socioeconomic status may be as important in determining IQ, a finding which could prove the strongest scientific support yet for programs like, say, Head Start. Well, joining us on the line from his home in Minnesota is Dr. Irving Gottesman of the University of Minnesota. He's one of the authors of the study, and welcome, Dr. Gottesman.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
To start, there's this tradition of studies that attempt to link IQ to genetic makeup. What's new about your findings?
We found that when you divide up the sample of identical and fraternal twins by their social class, which in this case is always going to be overlapping a lot with the issue of race, we found that for the children in the lower socioeconomic class, as defined by occupation, income, things like that, that the environmental components were overwhelming and the genetic component almost disappeared. Hmm. But when the same question is asked of the middle class and upper middle class children's data, we found the usual answer, which was that genetic factors were largely accounting for the differences among individuals.
In simple terms, if you're brought up poor and without a lot of books around, that's going to affect your IQ?
That's one of the reasonable conclusions.
But one of the reasonable conclusions is not that one group is genetically inferior to another, and that's why their IQ is lower.
That's right. The statement you just made is something that we would kick out with force from people's minds if we could.
Now, this has very important impact for programs like, say, Head Start. Critics of a program like Head Start will say, well, look, some kids just aren't ready to be taught quite the way others are. It's in the genes, and programs like that are a waste of time, right?
When they say that, then they're not looking at the total picture. I don't think it's all that crucial for people's IQ test scores to get better. It's much more important that they end up having as good an occupation as is possible for their level of cognitive ability.
Where genes do count is in a middle or upper class environment, there where people have a kind of level playing field as to the kind of education and opportunities they're getting.
Well, that's sort of correct, but I think the scientist in me would say you want to look at the big picture, and genes are going to be important for everybody, but environment's going to be important for everybody. But for the people who have inadequate environments with respect to those things that make our central nervous system work in a optimal fashion, that when those things are missing, then you see a big difference by adding them in. Whereas with those people who have what we might call, in the words of my former student, now retired Sandra Scar, when you have a good enough environment, then these big differences in the environment don't show up.
Yeah.
And that's what you see in countries that have national health insurance, such as Sweden, Denmark, United Kingdom. But that's because they've already taken care of this necessary environmental optimization.
Dr. Irving Gottesman, thank you very much for joining us on this.
Thanks for talking to me.
Dr. Irving Gottesman of the University of Minnesota. He's one of the authors of a new study on IQ.
There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Anyone who has seen The Godfather or The Godfather Part II will remember Fredo. Fredo, the brother who would eventually betray Michael. Fredo, the weak, underappreciated brother.
He said there was something in it for me, on my own.
I've always taken care of you, Fredo.
Taking care of me? You're my kid brother, and you take care of me? Did you ever think about that? Huh? Did you ever once think about that? Send Fredo off to do this, send Fredo off to do that. Send Fredo to pick somebody up at the airport. I'm your older brother, Mike, and I was stepped over.
That's the way Pop wanted it.
It ain't the way I wanted it!
Quick, name the actor who played Fredo. It's John Cazale, underappreciated brother and one of the great unsung character actors of all time. Until now. Some San Francisco Chronicle writers sat down one day and decided to right the wrongs of film history. They came up with a list of performers they thought deserved more recognition. And we've invited two of them to talk about their picks and maybe prompt you to think of some of your own. Joining us on the line from San Francisco is film critic Mick LaSalle. Hi, Mick.
Hello.
And also he's joined by his colleague, film reporter Carla Meyer. Hi, Carla.
Hi.
I have to say that I'm aware of your list because someone sent it to me because my brother is on it, John Savage, who is in The Deer Hunter.
you have a younger brother who's also an actor.
Okay, Jimmy Young's in Footloose, but we digress. Well, you guys know your stuff. But anyway, John Cazale, remind people, Mick or Carla, why don't you think he's been as recognized as he should be?
Well, I mean, first of all, to be honest, he died, okay? Mm-hmm. But, you know, he did make other movies. I think the reason why he's unrecognized, in a sense, for The Godfather is because he's so good in that movie that it's hard to imagine that he's acting. You know, we're very aware when we watch James Caan that it's a performance, and we kind of relish the performance, but it is a performance. But it's really hard to imagine that an intelligent man played Fredo until we kind of back up and think about what went into that performance.
Right. Well, Mick, tell us quick just a couple of your other picks on the list.
There's a few that are old that are things worth looking at, like Frederick March, for example, in the movie The Eagle and the Hawk, which is available on video and is like just one of the best performances of that actor's career, a very famous actor, in what I think is one of the most important pacifist films that came out of a major studio.
That's from 1933.
That's from 33.
Some of the other older films from 1932, Anne Harding in The Animal Kingdom.
Oh, yeah.
Leslie Howard in Intermezzo, that's in 1939.
I have some things I can't bring myself to say.
Yes, I know. I have a home, I have children, I'm a respected, responsible man. When I sit here and look at you, I only know one thing.
We must end it. We've got to stop seeing each other.
I think, for me especially, I think Leslie Howard gets a bad rap because of his Gone with the Wind character.
Yes.
And before I'd seen some of these pre-code films, some of these early 30s movies, I thought of him as being somewhat effeminate.
It's very reasonable, though, because the man, you know, he played in two of his biggest movies, A Free Soul and Gone with the Wind, he played opposite Clark Gable, and Gable, you know, can make any guy who stands next to him look like he'd be wearing a dress. I mean, that's just the way it is.
By the way, 1942, Ronald Reagan in Juke Girl?
Yeah, Ronald Reagan, he's excellent in that movie. I think that might be his best performance. And in fact, that has a lot of application now because a lot of people now in California are comparing Reagan to Schwarzenegger and saying we're going to have another bad actor as governor. But actually, it's not true. If we elect Schwarzenegger here, it'll be the first time we ever had a bad actor as a governor. But, you know, more recent years, you have Jennifer Jason Leigh, for example, in Georgia, which was, I think, 1996. I saw that movie. I was convinced she was going to win the Academy Award or at least be nominated. She played just a completely pathetic, no-talent singer with a drug problem. She was amazing, very unvain performance. And
she's playing Courtney Love.
The only thing that has any meaning is what's real, right? What we get, what we give each other. And in the dark, we're all scared. We're all scared. And there's more of us out there all the time, man.
Jennifer Jason Leigh in Georgia.
And you know, she wasn't nominated, nothing. It was just completely not noticed.
Mm. Well, we're noticing them now. And Carla, I know you have some that others might agree with as well. John Belushi in Continental Divide. Val Kilmer in Tombstone.
Oh, Val Kilmer in Tombstone is a fantastic performance. He plays Doc Holliday, and he's incredibly funny and brave and charismatic as he sort of wastes away in this part.
You must be Doc Holliday.
You must be Ringo. What do you think, darling? Should I hate him?
You don't even know him.
No, that's true, but I don't know. There's just something about him. Something around the eyes. I don't know. Reminds me of me. No. I'm sure of it. I hate him.
More on the list. Russell Crowe in 1994's The Sum of Us. A lot of people think that's one of the better films he's ever made.
It actually is because it was before he had the sort of persona. I've found in his recent films that I can see him acting much of the time. Not that he's not a completely dynamic performer most of the time, but with this, he was completely lost in this role. I mean, he played a very good-natured gay guy.
I got my place. I like you, mate. You know, I don't just mean sex. We don't have to do that if you'd rather not. I like you as a person, you know. I feel comfy with you. Just don't go, please. We can talk. Get to know each other a bit. Wasting my breath, aren't I?
Sorry.
No, I'm sorry.
Russell Crowe in 1994's The Sum of Us. Well, Mick, some of your other picks included Elizabeth Berridge in Amadeus, Madeline Stowe, Last of the Mohicans. But there were films that you two split on. For example, Mick didn't think that 1933's Babyface qualified as unsung, but Carla, you picked it.
You know, Mick is an expert on pre-code films, and as part of my education on it, I saw Babyface starring Barbara Stanwyck, and she plays a woman who basically sleeps her way to the top of the corporate ladder. And I just found it just a completely all-out wonderful performance. I think it is unsung. I think it's just not unsung by Mick.
Yeah, I think so. I think I just have an exaggerated sense about, you know, how many people know this movie, because it's something that I'm very familiar with. And it's a good example of the kind of movies that could be made before censorship, because her behavior in this movie is completely appalling. and in a way that everyone will appreciate.
Say, I like it here. How about a job?
Well, we don't...
Oh, now, don't tell me in this great big building there ain't someplace for me.
Have you had any experience?
Plenty. I'd rather wait in there. I hate crowds. Don't you?
The boss won't be back for an hour.
Well, then why don't we go in and talk this over?
This is a great way to go back and look at movies.
It is, isn't it? Because you, it also gives you something to look at when you go back and look. You know, just kind of directs your viewing, which is always nice.
It was hard for us not to duplicate these, and it's because there were a lot of unsung actors who've delivered great performances in several movies. So drawing attention to one, I hope that interests folks in these actors' other movies as well.
And that brings us right back to the late John Cazale. In addition to The Godfather, he was also greatly unsung in The Deer Hunter and in Dog Day Afternoon, both great films to check out. Well, I want to thank you both.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Mick LaSalle, film critic, and Carla Meyer, film reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. If you have nominees of your own for unsung great performances, or if you'd like to see theirs, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
We can be there just for one day.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
Hearings begin in Washington on the great blackout of 2003.
And the four most painful preschool words, "They don't like me." How to help little kids deal with bullies and teasing in the classroom.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.